Hey, Brother John.
Good morning.
Wow.
So, enjoying my time down here in Florida. Looks like I'm going to have a pretty good day in the 70s. And another baseball game, spring training.
Fantastic.
So far, so good.
Yeah, it's incredibly cold up here. We had, as I told you yesterday, we had kind of a northeast wind. And it's been blowing the cold weather down here, so... Yeah, we're down in the low 40s, so kind of unusual.
Yeah, it's I just listened to the forecast. It's pretty bad. It's in the mid-20s in Chicago with 6 inches of snow yesterday, and they're expecting another 3 to 6 today, mostly lakefront, which is, of course, where I live. So
yep.
I'm escaping some bad weather, which is okay with me.
Yeah. I talked to Mom yesterday, and they didn't get much snow, but you know, they got some. Yeah. So anyways, so what's going on in the world of sports down there? You're at spring training.
Yeah, I've been going to spring training since 1977. It's something I always look forward to because baseball is always very positive during the spring. Nothing can go wrong except for perhaps injury. You're not necessarily playing to win, so if you lose, it's okay. There's always something positive that happens during a game. So I'm located on the Gulf side, Sarasota, Florida, and there I can see probably I'm within pretty good driving distance to see three different locations: Bradenton, Sarasota, Port Charlotte. So I kind of bounce around and look for a good game and usually head out. I came in Tampa and saw the Yankees play the Tigers, and then that was on Saturday. Sunday, I went to Port Charlotte to watch the Blue Jays play the Rays, and then yesterday I went to Sarasota and watched the Baltimore Orioles play the Philadelphia Phillies. It's not spring training as I remember it back in the 70s. It's become a big business. You find people are basically planning their vacations around coming down here. I think the most amazing thing I've seen down here that I didn't really, I knew but I hadn't forgotten about, is the influx of Canadians, the snowbirds from Toronto. I go to a game in Port Charlotte where the Blue Jays are the opposing team, they're the away team, and I realize that the crowd is more Blue Jays fans because of all the snowbirds that they're up in Dunedin, Florida. That's where their Jays location is, and all of a sudden, it's like I can't tell who's the home team or the away team based upon the crowd reaction. It was crazy, and a sellout, which I wasn't expected because it very seldom did the Rays sell out down in Port Charlotte, but it was a pretty interesting time. So, you sort of look at baseball players and what they're doing, the prospects, individuals rather than overall result, because spring training results can be very misleading. They quite often don't indicate what the team will do once it heads north. So I've had a good time. Yesterday was my worst weather day, and it just sprinkled a little bit. And I'm looking forward to sunshine the rest of the time I'm down here. So
cool,
pretty good.
Cool.
Just kind of veg out on baseball, read a little bit, and relax, and kind of take in some of Sarasota. And so far, it's gone very well for me. I can't complain.
How does it compare to, I know you go to Arizona
the thing is that I find that because I have a timeshare here and I've been going here more often, I've only gone to Arizona maybe 6 or 7 times, mostly in recent years. I think number one, you're weather-wise, you're going to have, in Arizona, you're very, very seldom going to have a rain out. While here in Florida, you've always run the risk that there's probably within a week you might have a game call because of rain. So the weather is a little more conducive to the baseball in terms of lack of rain. On the other side of it, players typically prefer to play down here in Florida because It's a much more conducive to the conditions up north. In Arizona, the air is so light that you sometimes get a misconception as to how well you're doing. For example, yesterday after I watched my game, I turn on the radio and I find out the Brewers are leading their game in Arizona 24-1. Now, whoa, they scored 24 whoa runs. Now, that's not going to typically happen up north, and it's all because of the light air and, you know, and then the ball carries further and this and that. So you get
I was
a much
ask you about that.
Yeah. So, you know, that's one of the big differences that I notice. Travel wise, it's probably everybody will tell you it's easier in Arizona because Arizona the teams are all closer together, so you can travel around and see the teams. Here, for example, yesterday I had to travel about 35 miles. Actually, yesterday is Sarasota, so I only had to travel about 7 or 8 miles. But if I go to Port Charlotte, it's going to be about 40 miles. If I go to Fort Myers, which I'll do tomorrow, it's going to be about 80 miles. But the difference is that the traffic down here is nowhere near as bad as Arizona. So I could have to travel, you know, to see a night game in Arizona, and I could be, you know, in Scottsdale and have to go all the way across east to maybe, for example, a Goodyear. And that trip, which is probably, 20 minutes on non-rush, is going to take me probably close to an hour and a half if I really want to hit the brunt of the rush hour traffic, because the traffic is really bad in the Phoenix area. So as much as people say, well, you're traveling a lot more, you know, when you're in Florida, in terms of hours, I don't think there's a lot of difference.
Wow.
So
yeah, that's something to think about right there.
Yeah.
Hey, about the distance the ball travels, that got me thinking. Now, if they're playing someplace like Denver where the altitude is a mile, does that make a difference too?
Yeah, but it's interesting because you see, here's what's kind of interesting. You got Denver is a place, is the place everybody points out. So what the teams will do, what the Rockies, the Colorado Rockies have done in terms of their ballpark is they make the ballpark bigger, which makes sense, so that you have to hit the ball further to go out. But all that does is increase the hitting, because what it does is it makes
more field to cover.
And as a result, there's a lot more hits. Colorado has tried, you know, they thought, oh, we got the solution. We're going to get the fastest outfielders we can find and put them out there to catch balls. The other thing is that in terms of pitching, it just seems like the curveball it takes more effort to get a sharp breaking curve.
And, sure.
Yeah. So the problem might not be that you can't get the ball to curve. The problem might be that you put so much effort into it, you could hurt your arm or do something unusual. So I've seen players go out there that are determined, competitive pitchers, who end up, you know, messing themselves up because they try too hard to overcome the elements of, you know, the height, the altitude.
Not just that, but you know, like my friend Dave, he just moved to a high altitude area, and he, of course, he has trouble breathing because the air is so thin. I wonder if that is a factor also. How do you get enough oxygen to replenish your muscles?
Is that I think the players, you know, that doesn't seem to be as big an effect as this whole thing with the baseball in terms of the, you know, the distance it'll carry on a hit ball and also the pitching.
Right.
The whole thing with the air, usually that's through more longer, you know, stints, of activity. And baseball is sort of like a stop-start thing. The pitchers might feel it a little bit because they're out there exerting themselves.
Right.
But the rest of the team probably is not affected that much. Yeah, it's kind of funny. I ran into the town in Colorado with the highest altitude. I think it's Leadville. When I was in the Army, I was running. We were doing a 2-mile run for a drill, And the guy who, one of the guys who I worked with, he was from Leadville, and he was a, I mean, he was a prolific smoker. So I thought, this guy will be easy to beat. Man, he ran rings around me because he was from Leadville. He was used to the high altitude. I mean, smoking didn't make any difference.
That's right. That's right. I never thought of that.
Yeah, so that was pretty. So that's my experience with high altitude in terms of the effect upon performance. So
we moved to Denver back in the 70s for a couple of years and had our first child, Rose, there. And the Mile High Baby. And I had a hell of a time for a while.
Oh, really?
For me, I did. The breathing, it took me a while to get used to it. But after, some period of time, you do adjust. It's not that long, maybe a month at the most. But then the other thing, for me anyway, was I'm used to the Midwest kind of weather. St. Louis humidity is famous. It's pretty high. It's not like it is in the South, but it's still pretty high because we're in river country there, and it lies kind of low. And so I wasn't used to the dryness. And, you have to take precautions to keep your nose from drying out, nosebleeds, all kinds of stuff. So, that for me was more of a problem, actually, long-term, than the thin air and all that stuff. But anyway, you're in Florida where it's nice and humid.
It's fairly humid. I mean, the weather so far, it's been in the 70s. It hasn't, like I said, a little bit of rain. I don't feel the humidity. Yesterday, it was like because of the clouds and everything, I was kind of thankful because that was the first day I actually had a seat out outside of the shade. And since it was cloudy, I felt really good that I... But today the sunscreen's going to break out because it's going to be sunny, and a friend of mine has good seats, so I'll be sitting, pretty close to the action. And that's the other thing down here, if you want to get a close view of players, and if it's so close, you got to really be careful. Yesterday, a bat kind of came pretty close to me. Some player let go of a bat, so sometimes it's not just the baseballs, it's the bats you got to watch that might hit the stands.
Wow.
So it just seems like everything's a little closer than it is up north in terms of that. You got to be really, really careful, and that can be a challenge for me because me and my baseball friend that I went with yesterday, we're both kind of scoring, and it can get a little tedious trying to score a spring training game because there's a lot of change in pitchers because pitchers this early in spring training usually don't go more than 3 or 4 innings, and then after that it's one pitcher per inning. And then about the fifth or sixth inning, the regulars are all removed from the game and they put in substitutes. So you're just making a mad scramble to try to figure out what the heck's going on. Without my phone and keeping track of it on MLB.com, I would probably be in pretty sad shape when my scorecard would not be looking very good.
Because of all the substitutions.
Like I said, the thing that I like about spring training, I like to look for the prospects that are going to play, players I haven't seen. And the other thing I enjoy is I enjoy seeing players make their last try, the last hurrah, their last chance to make it in baseball. And quite often you'll see a player who wants to give it one more try. So what he'll do is he will, he'll try to latch on and become what they call a non-roster invitee. The major league club will say, okay, we're not going to put you on the roster, but you can come down and we'll just see if you got anything left. And maybe they'll let him go down in the minors for a little while. So I like to see some of these guys who are just kind of hanging on. So that's my other thing I look for. And I also look for players I used to see on my club, the Cardinals or maybe the White Sox or the Chicago Cubs, and see what they're up to, now that they're maybe trying out for another team. So there's all kinds of stuff going on like that.
One question I have for you that came to mind, and this may be a stupid question, but I'm not nearly as deep into baseball or most any sports as you are, but my question is, how long before women start playing professional baseball?
The thing is that women have tried to enter baseball in a variety of ways. There have been a couple of women who have played in the lower minors to some extent, but they just don't seem to have the velocity to pitch. And so a result, they usually
pitching,
don't.
Of course.
Yeah. Position wise, you know, it's usually they try out as pitchers. There's not
really?
Too many that have you know tried out for position wise. So, you know, I'm not. Believe me, I've worked for women practically my whole life. So I'm not about to make any comment about their ability to pitch the ball and how well they do.
There is physiology involved, though. I mean,
there is physiology, but I'm not going to go there.
Boy, you've been well trained.
Yes, I have. But I'll tell you what's more interesting about in baseball is women's have made a big effort and come fairly close to becoming umpires.
Oh, really?
Yeah, there's been.
I wouldn't
have
thought of that. See, it never would have occurred to me.
So you know, there's been two women. In fact, one, I went to a ball game in Kane County, that's outside of Chicago, and I didn't realize that this woman there was a woman that was actually calling balls and strikes behind home plate. I didn't realize it was a woman until after the game was over with. So I kind of followed her after that. She made it up to Double A. There's been one other woman who's made it to Triple A. It's tough. It just seems like there's a glass ceiling that they haven't been able to break. But that would be the area. There's also been women who have tried that have interviewed to become general managers. In other words, not managers, but the ones who basically make the decisions as to who the players are going to be.
Right.
And so there's been that's another area. Well, women are then there's sports writers. Women now are allowed to go into the clubhouses and do their sports stories just like men do.
Hmm.
So women are making their way into baseball, but it's just not on the field.
Right, right. Gotcha.
So
let's switch subjects here for a
bit. Yeah, it sounds good.
we've got an interesting film today to talk about. You turned me on to this thing, and I did a little research on it. And I have to say that, this is one of the more interesting movies. It got quite a bit of acclaim and coverage and all kinds of good stuff when it came out. If I was an English speaker, I would pronounce it Jean Dielman, but it's Jean Dumont. If it was French. But I noticed also that the name of the movie includes the address of her apartment where, if I'm not mistaken, almost the entire movie takes place, or maybe it does.
Yeah, there's a couple of scenes outside her apartment. Just to kind of give you a little background, this is a movie that was filmed in Belgium. It's a French, but it's the speak French in it, and it deals with the 3 days of the life of a housewife whose husband's been dead for 6 years, and she has basically her life has been become sort of a mechanical regiment of doing things every day. So it shows 3 days of her life. Now, the thing about the movie is it's over 3 hours long. It's very, very long. And it's the appearance of real time. So what we find is that this woman, and the movie is directed by, Chante, Ackerman, a French, I don't know if she's French or not, but a female director, and the movie has tones of underlying tones of feminist in it. So what we have is we have a showing this rather mundane, boring, just regiment, same household chores that this woman is doing for 3 days. So it starts out, you know, and so when I turned this movie on, I only watched like the last half hour. But if you would have turned this movie on, you would have been thinking you were watching a cooking show. Because it's sort of like you're watching a woman, and even though you don't need subtitles, because she's most of the movie she's alone. So when I turned it on, she was making coffee, and it took forever for her to make coffee. I saw some clips about earlier parts of it where it shows her kneading meatloaf. You know, she's making meatloaf, so she's kneading this, and you just watch her forever doing this. So she's polishing, she's cleaning. The interactions that she has with others, she ends up having where she cares. In other words, another woman brings over her baby so that the woman who's, you know, the housewife is caring for that child. So you see a little bit of that. The other thing that makes it kind of interesting is because she has a son and treats her son more like a boarder than she does a son. I mean, concerned of, you know, making sure that everything's properly done and this and that for him.
Yes.
And the third interaction she has is that she needs to have money. So to have money, she basically is a prostitute in the afternoon and turns occasional tricks and has a regular clientele. So she also treats her job as a prostitute in the same way she does the rest of her life. It's just like it's going through the motions. It's like she's a robot. So the idea of the 3 days is that you see that by the second day things are starting to unravel a little bit. she ends up.
Hold on a second here. We have to alert everybody. If you don't want to hear more about the movie and have it spoiled, then you should tune out and tune back in
spoiler
about
alert.
10 minutes. Spoiler alert. 10
the
minutes, we'll alert. Be done with this, and we'll be on to the fake news. But, yes, okay. So
quickly, to get through the 3 days. So in the second day, she burns her meal, and she gets a little flustered. And so a couple other things go wrong. Before you know it, she looks rather disheveled, I guess. You know, her hair is not quite done right. And
because she's extremely fastidious. That's she's like, everything is fastidious. Her clothing, her appearance, how she deals with her son. Yeah. She's correcting him all the time and keeping him on schedule, like you said, and all that kind of stuff.
It's all clockwork.
But man, she is like super fastidious. Also, I might point out, there's also another alert with this movie, is do not watch this movie on an empty stomach, or if you do, be prepared to eat while you watch the movie. Otherwise, you'll be starving by the end of it because there's a lot of cooking. Enough cooking.
Yeah.
One other interesting aside before we get to what goes on with the plot, because I think this is really amazing. The other thing about it is I went on YouTube, and of course, the movie itself, I believe, is on YouTube.
Yeah.
It's part of the Criterion collection, which is probably on another streaming service or a movie cable channel, because Criterion stuff is pretty famous, and that's quite a mark if you can get up there. But one of the interesting things about this this whole thing she's doing and all this stuff is that it's inconceivable how slow and how methodical she is. So people have been posting videos. This is like the equivalent of Rocky Horror, where people get in front of the movie, the projection of the movie, and act out and say the lines and stuff. These people are cooking. There's a cooking component to this that's become viral, where people are simulating her cooking in a video.
Yeah, it's
this is a kind of a huge movie if you're really into movies, films.
Yeah, I would say that, you know, just to kind of, I think, you know, we kind of reached the point where we need to kind of move on to the
advance.
Third day, and so she's basically she's gone through the first half of her day, and she has her client comes in in the afternoon, and they ended up having sex. But during the sex, for the first time in her life, she has an orgasm, and this is something that just completely unravels her. So as a result of that, she gets up. Her customer is still in bed, kind of just relaxing after everything's all done. And she picks up a pair of scissors and kills him. So,
wow.
I mean, that kind of comes out of nowhere. But
yeah, especially the way the rest of the movie has gone. Because, like, usually when she has a client, From my reading, I haven't watched the whole movie yet. From my reading, it says, like, usually when she has a client, the camera just kind of remains at the hallway, and what you see while she's servicing her client is the door. So, in fact, the phrase was, the camera sits in the hall like an obedient dog waiting.
Yeah.
So, this one, the camera's inside, I assume.
There's nothing graphic in the movie, but they're her last caught client. You basically see them in bed. But,
right.
You know, it's just, she's basically laying there, although this time she's not quite laying as still as she did the other two times.
Wow.
And after, you would think then, well, what happens after that? Well, she just kind of gets up and she just, after killing him, and she's kind of staring out the window, and the movie ends. So, this movie, I guess the best way to describe it is singular. You're not going to find another movie like it, out there. And in that regard, I think it's kind of got a unique place in when it comes to movie history and reviewing movies. And, it's gotten some very, very good reviews in terms of the fact of its uniqueness, I think is probably its biggest feature. So that was mind-boggling, because that movie was on Turner Classic Movies. It was on Monday morning at 3:00. I kind of wake up and all of a sudden I look over there and I thought, gee, what's this? And I then, you know, find out what the movie is, and I read a little bit about it, and I said, well, it's worth watching at least the last half hour of it. And of course, most people, you know, obviously would watch the whole thing. But it's a interesting and unique movie to see, no doubt.
Yeah, and there's a New York Times review of the movie that I found was excellent. It's not too long, but they do cover a lot of the basics, and they also, it's kind of like they prep you for watching the movie. They give you the warning about the food and that you better be prepared, and also they say you really have to pay attention, although it would seem you don't, that you could do other things while you're watching a movie. They encourage the viewer to actually immerse yourself in it. I would imagine this is not a movie also you'd want to watch if you were, just had your morning cup of coffee or what have you, because you'd be antsy. So you gotta.
Yeah.
I don't think you have to take Quaaludes or anything to watch it, but
you'd be very anxious watching it, because you'd say, because there's little action is probably an overstatement. There's virtually no action. Other than this, you know, like I said,
cooking,
moving around the household, and so I guess
out of curiosity, what kind of coffee did she make?
I don't know.
Was it
was a plunger
French
type thing.
French press. Okay.
Yeah. It was, I would say that what you get out of the movie, since it's got this feminist sort of like overtone to it, is that, you know, women, it kind of is trying to overstate the boring, duties that quite often, is kind of locked into. And
yeah.
What happens when, you know, you basically, you know, what can happen if you get caught up in that, it almost can drive you crazy in a kind of a subtle way. And that's what happened here.
Wow.
So this movie actually came out in 75. It hit the film festival trail pretty heavy in Europe, but actually wasn't seen in the U.S. and didn't hit the big screen in the U.S. until the early 80s. So it kind of, you know, had a kind of a slow following.
Gee.
To start out with. And I'm going to let you, Jerry, actually just mention the name of the woman. And we also should mention the name of the movie again, which is Jean Delmont. But if you were going to look at it as a English, but you pronounce it better, Jerry, in terms of the right way.
Jean Delmont.
Yeah. And the actress's name is, you can give that one a shot too.
Yeah, sure. Delphine Seyrig.
Seyrig, and she is very, very well known in France.
You had another couple interesting things about her too. She has kind of a unique voicing. Not that we heard her talk that much in this movie,
no.
I guess.
No, yeah, she's got a throaty kind of voice. considered pretty sexy, a little low, that, you know, gives her a unique, you know, delivery in terms
of
her
talking.
Yeah,
she was a big smoker, I guess, and died of lung cancer, I would suppose, or
something like that. Lung cancer, had respiratory problems at the end, and she died at, I think, the age of 58 or, you know, fairly young.
She was really famous, though. I mean, she, in the write-ups, they said there's no actress to compare to her, you know, except maybe Garbo or somebody like that.
She's compared to Garbo. The thing about it is that quite often the movies she's in, she like, for example, she was in the Day of the Jackal, which is a fairly well-known English movie. But if you look at the credits, she's like fifth listed in the credits. So it seemed like she didn't have the ego that she had to be top billed. And quite often she would star with other famous actors and actresses in movies. So, you know, you can probably capture her the main English movie she made. But she was Truffaut, well-known French director. There was a bunch of them that she basically were directors of her movies.
So yeah, Ackerman does the interviews about her and the movie on YouTube also.
Yeah. So amazing. Just like one of those names you just don't hear much about, but really had a great following, particularly in Europe.
Yeah, so. Well, now for something completely different.
Yeah.
We've got what's going on in the United States with our politics and our news. I'd say politics are dominating the news these days in the U.S. In a most unusual way. I don't think I need to dwell on that. Everybody knows. But man, what a week. What a week.
Yeah, it's just so much, it's hard to say where to start in terms of Trump.
Let's start with the wiretapping accusations that started last Saturday, but the Saturday before. That was super weird. So the President Trump made the accusations on Twitter, which kind of broke his streak of being a president.
Yeah, he was presidential before, for a couple of days.
Well, yeah, a little bit more than that actually. It was sort of midweek or Tuesday, I think, or something. He gave the joint session of Congress, which went over really well, and he really did a good job. He stayed on the teleprompter. Stayed on message. Parts of that were even a little crazy, but people gave him so much slack because of how totally, I have to use the word insane, some of his stuff is. But he stayed pretty much on track. He veered a little more back to what he promised during his campaign, which was really pretty good stuff. But then, you know, as we talked about last week, I predicted that, just watch the tweets. The guy's going to go off the rails again. It's unavoidable. It's just a question of when and what to look for. And sure enough, Saturday morning tweets. And I guess what drove him to this was the fact that he had his attorney general recuse himself, Jeff Sessions, of being involved in any of the investigations that were going to go on to determine his and other members of his administration's connection to Vladimir Putin and his cronies and oligarchs, and not to mention the hacking underground, which is a whole other aspect of this story, which is pretty amazing. So anyways, he went off the rails with the Jeff Sessions thing, went into a tirade Friday night down this Largo, whatever it is,
his retreat down in Florida.
Yeah, the Winter White House. Mar-a-Lago. Yeah. So anyway, he and then by Saturday morning, I guess it was just, you know, boiling over and he couldn't resist it. So now he's got to go online on Twitter and say unequivocally that President Obama tapped his phones. And it was very declarative, very specific, very clear. He repeated this in numerous tweets, called the president sick or a bad guy. Compared it to Watergate. He really went full bore in about five tweets. And so, wow, that weekend was totally all about, you know, this extraordinary, quote-unquote, you know, the talking heads went crazy. all the shows, news shows covered it. And so, yeah, once everybody kind of got their wind back, and because it's like a sucker punch to the stomach, right?
Yeah.
And they're going, what? You know, no one knew what the hell to do. And where's the evidence? Where's the evidence? So then this came to a head last week where finally, I think it was Thursday or Friday, intelligence, what is it? I can't keep this straight. There's a committee that does intelligence.
Yeah, there's a congressional committee that basically requested the Department of Justice look into this to see if there's any truth to these allegations. And the Department of Justice has said, said it's going to take some time, but they'll get to it. But it's not going to, you know, work its way out real quick.
But I think that's what he had a deadline. The extraordinary thing is the deadline. He had a deadline of yesterday or 2 days ago, Monday.
Oh, you mean Trump?
Yeah, he was given a deadline. The White House, I should say, was given the deadline. And then, of course, Monday came around. He had to the end of business Monday. That's 5 o'clock Eastern time. And nothing. A big goose egg. Nothing happened. And so everyone went nuts about that, too. And it, not only nothing happened, the Justice Department did ask for an extension. But here's the thing. You know, when this hit Obama, you know, he, of course, completely denied. And then secondarily, you know, now you got people coming up and saying stuff. The big one for me is Kane.
Yeah.
John Kane.
Said,
He comes forward and he says, well, you know, this can be quickly remedied. There's a 1-minute solution to this. All the president has to do is make a call to any intelligence bureau and they can give him the answer to this. If indeed he doesn't have anything, which is crazy, you know, if you have something, then you have to say what it is. And of course he won't say what it is because we all know it came from Breitbart News or some stupid alt news thing. And so he's got nothing. And also, this is like devolving back to the weapons of mass destruction scenario where Cheney instructed the intelligence agencies to come up with something.
Yeah.
Not that there was anything, but to come up with something. And this is the same deal. That happened also. Through back channels, it was leaked that he instructed some group in some intelligence agency come up with something, and no. No, they refused. And so now, you know, I don't know what I got a feeling he's just going to be left twisting in the wind. And they're going to, now what they've done is they've done two things. The White House has done two things interesting through spokesman, not through Trump. Trump is shtum on this. He's not saying a word. So, yeah. So what they say are two things. Number one, you know, by wiretap, what the president actually meant was any form of surveillance.
I know that was the press secretary. In other words, trying to alter the definition of wiretapping.
Second thing, what they did was not Obama. When he said Obama, he didn't mean President Obama. What he meant was the administration and all its intelligence paraphernalia. So they broadened it so broad that, of course, you know, that last one, we know that there's surveillance going on because these guys are talking to Russians and the Russians are getting intercepted and they have all that stuff recorded. So now they're trying to broaden the scope of this thing to the point where it's meaningless and blah, blah, blah. So in the end, what do you think is going to happen?
Well, I don't know. I hope it comes to a head where they, you know, you would think that, I can't imagine the president admitting to a mistake. So I'm sure they're just going to keep tap dancing, is the way I look at it.
You think it's going to go the way of birtherism?
I don't know.
It'll just kind of hang out there forever and not get resolved. I don't know. There's you know, like Kane said, you know, he said, you've either got to put up or shut up. He said, you've got to say what it is that you know, heard, etc., or take it back. You know, you've got, what's the word? He had a good word for it. I can't remember what it is right now, but yeah, you have to, you said it, admit you made a mistake, but recant or something.
Yeah.
Recant, I think that's what it was, yeah. So this is a big mess, and actually, this is overshadowing what the real show is, of course. This is distracting people from the healthcare stuff that's they're trying to jam through right now, and which is also another big, huge mess. It's, you know, Obamacare Lite, I think, is pretty much what it is. Well, it's a little more pernicious, I think, than Obamacare Lite. You know, it keeps a few of the things of Obamacare in play, but it's going to throw... And the other thing, too, is they 4:30 in the morning, they took this out of committee in the House of Representatives to get it, to try and get it on the floor as quickly as possible. And then they did this without the Congressional Budget Office, the CBO, saying anything about the numbers. The numbers are important here. How many people are going to get thrown off of health care? How much is this going to cost? And, you know, and what are the savings also? So that's what they do. And, by the way, the head of this thing is Republican appointed to keep an eye on Obamacare when it was going through. And they put Obamacare through this, and they wouldn't let it go anywhere until these numbers were in. But this time, 4:30 in the morning, they push it out of committee. They're trying to get it on the floor of the House, and all this nonsense. And CBO finally did come out yesterday, I think it was, wasn't it? Yeah yesterday.
Yeah, with the number of people that were going to lose insurance.
Much worse. Yeah. And, of course, knowing that the numbers would be bad and CBO would be doing putting their numbers out, the head of the House he's going like, well, now he starts to walk it back too, just like this other stuff we're talking about. Well, no, the real thing is this is American. And that's the first word in the act, the American Health Care Act. And it's American to have a choice, not to have the government, you know, crammed aside. So they go into all this kind of libertarian style defense of this thing and kind of trying to soft pedal the fact that a lot of people are not going to have health care. This is a step backwards. It's not even Obamacare Lite. It's, you know, Obamacare on a diet or something, or a severe fasting.
Yeah. Well, to me, looking at it, it's just so, you know, I personally would be interested in the details of it. But the fact is, it's not even worth looking into until it's got a chance of passing. So I just...
Okay, well, hard. Will it pass the House? That's the,
yeah,
the
I know,
big but, question.
Yeah, that's the it's question.
Tight. Yeah, it's tight. It's not a given. But yeah. Let's assume they get it through. And a lot of Republican senators, not a lot, but enough, have said, no way.
Right.
We're not going to do it. You know, and they even warned. One Democratic member of the House said to the Democrats, to the Republicans, hey guys, you know, even if somehow you get it through here, it's going to get kicked back. And that's not a good thing for you. If you right. care about your careers and your electability and all that stuff, because they got midterms, right? 2018.
Right, coming up.
If you care about anything at all, you don't do this. You know, take a little more time, slow this thing down, let's talk. You know, let's do what we're supposed to do. Let's do our jobs instead of jamming things through. So, here's what it looks like in the Senate side. The Senate side, as you know, the conservatives don't like it because it doesn't cut enough. It's just Obamacare Lite, according to them. And then the moderates are going, well, hey, you want to come and talk to my constituents? Because they're pretty pissed off about this.
Right.
You know, it cuts too much. And then there's some middle ground here where they're enthusiastic about it. But regardless of all that, the agenda in the Senate is we're going to put it up for a vote. No discussion.
Wow.
I know. And if you compare this to, you know, I listen to this podcast, Pod Save America? I don't know if you ever listened to it. It's hilarious. But it's former Obama guys. Pretty high up Obama guys involved in, and most of them are communication speech writers. I think there's a guy who did intelligence work too with them. So they went on and they said, wow, you know, they went through what happened with Obamacare with regard to all these issues. And it's just like, and remember, these are reverse times. The Democrats did have the majority and they could have done what the Republicans are doing right now. But they didn't. They listened and honored the requests of the Republicans. They had discussion. They had the CBO numbers. They did everything right according to Hoyle. Of course, it took 6 months to get it through.
Yeah.
And a lot of wrangling and a lot of compromise, which a lot of progressives on the Democratic side hated. But and everybody acknowledged, even the president, it's not perfect. But if we don't do this the way it is now, we're not going to get anything. And I think that's kind of the way Ryan is trying to sell this to the House of Representatives. Look, this is our best shot. We can come back and pick away at this later, but let's get it through, you know, put our differences aside. So I guess that's probably the only way it's going to get through either the Senate or the House of Representatives. It's a cluster, my friend. It's a cluster.
Yeah, it's a real mess, no doubt. And I mean, we could look at, there are so many of these little pieces like this. So I mean, we're talking about the big ones, but there's so many other little ones that are getting so screwed up. We could, you know, pick a U.S. attorneys, the way it's been handled, the way they were all, you know, they're all going to be let go. We know that, but the way that it's been done, it's like a lot of these guys are in the middle of important cases all over the country, and all of a sudden they're told, you're gone. What's going to happen to those cases that they're trying to, you know, prosecute right now?
And President Trump is trying to strip the executive branch of a lot of its personnel. I mean, a lot. He wants to strip that down to nothing because, I guess, you know, the management's interfering with his golf game or something, or I don't know what's going on there, what the rationale is. Supposedly, it's to save money. But, you know what's going to happen as a result? Communication with the public, interaction with other agents, with other branches of government, all that stuff's going to go to hell in a handbasket because you need a lot of people to man the phones, to do all kinds of, you know, Jean Dumont level stuff, you know,
yeah.
From making coffee to handling faxes and whatever goes on in there. You know, it's a very labor intensive thing. You know, that's government. It's not Trump Tower. It's not a TV show. This is government. And I just think that's our biggest problem with all this stuff, is he just has not made the transition and figured out that there's a way things are done. Yes, it needs change. I'm not going to argue with that. I don't think anybody is. But that's not the kind of change it needs. It needs a different kind of change. It needs vision and direction you know, people need to acknowledge and communicate with their constituents. And, of course, this is going to wall off the White House even more. It's going to end up more of an echo chamber or a bubble. So this is not good stuff.